Hello, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. I hope you enjoy this conversation from our 2020 podcast series that happens in partnership with Guardian Australia as part of their online book club.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special Sydney Writers Festival edition of Guardian Australia's book club. It feels very, very good not to be refreshing a live blog right now. I am Steph Harmon, the culture editor of Guardian Australia, and I'm so excited to introduce our guest, Helen Garner, today. But before we get there, I want to acknowledge that we are hosting this from Indigenous land. I'm in my home on the Darwal land of the South Coast. I know you'll join me in paying respects to elders past and present and in recognising that this land was never ceded. A little bit of housekeeping for those who haven't been involved in one of Australia at Home's Zoom talks before. If you turn your cameras on and turn your screen to gallery mode on the top right corner, you'll be able to see all of the faces who have joined us today. Don't worry, you've all been muted for now. If you open up the chat on the bottom of the screen, you can type in to introduce yourselves and ask questions that you'd like to get posed to Helen Garner, or just ask questions to each other, or just chat away while the discussion's happening. We'll be scanning the chat for the best questions and calling members of the audience up during the conversation. So if you have posed a question, look out for a message from one of our organisers. They might invite you up to unmute your mic and ask the question to Helen yourself. Finally, we are filming this and we're live streaming it too, so please keep yourselves nice. Helen Garner is a giant of Australian literature who really needs no introduction. She has written some of Australia's most important, beloved and influential works of fiction and non-fiction. And that whole time, she has also been keeping a diary. While Helen made the very relatable decision to set fire to her earliest journals, she's releasing the latter ones for us to pore over, the second volume of which, One Day I'll Remember This, has just come out. She's here to discuss it with our host, Michael Williams. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Steph.
Thank you. Thanks, Steph.
And hello, everyone. As Steph said, we've done multiple versions of this book club so far, and it's a wonderful way to be able to have a chat to extraordinary writers, but in a way that you can genuinely participate. A warning right from the outset, I would happily sit and talk to Helen Garner for many, many hours without letting any of you get a word in edgeways. So if you have questions, put them in the chat and we will try and get to them across the space of this hour. Helen, it's so wonderful to see your face. It's so wonderful to get the chance to talk to you on the advent of the publication of the second volume of your diaries.
Thanks.
I wanted to ask, going into this book, how does it differ from this time 12 months ago when you were publishing your diaries for the first time? What are the things you learned about how it feels to share those private words with the world?
Both times it feels like my guts are hanging out on a clothesline, to be perfectly frank. It's a very peculiar situation. It's a bit like being a ghost in your former life, just hanging over this record of the past, and other people are going to be looking at it, and it's really quite bad night's sleep making. You know, but at the moment, the anxiety about what's happening in America is so awful, and then the whole business of the lockdown and coming out of the lockdown, which makes me feel kind of timid and traumatised. I just don't know what to attribute to what cause. But I've taken heart from the way that people have responded to the first one, and I just thought, well, I might as well just go for it. And so that's what I've done.
You're committed. It's the big trap of putting volume one on a book. You're on the train tracks now and there's no getting off.
No, and at the end of every one there's a cliffhanger, so I have to do the next one. But that's all right, yeah. It's kind of, on one level it's actually quite fun because it's not ordinary writing, it's editing. You know, the stuff is already written. And as with the first one, I made a sort of promise to myself that I wouldn't rewrite. I've only rewritten things. It's mostly a matter of cutting and filleting and throwing stuff away, which is a great pleasure to me, throwing away things, I mean.
When the first volume came out, amongst the anxieties, obviously one of the pressures that you felt was people reading themselves in the diaries and how they would respond to that kind of being aired and shared in public. Did that change the editing process on the second book? Did you have any responses the first time around that gave you pause or made you approach it differently?
No, I didn't actually. Let me see. It's hard to cast my mind back to the detail of it. No, I was expecting. I did let people know that I was publishing the diary, and I tried to explain the process that I was using and the disidentifying of people, and. This is well in advance, and I was quite surprised by how many of the people I contacted said, some people I said, look, do you want to see the bit that concerns you? And I don't think there was anyone who wanted to see it. Most people said, go ahead, I trust you, which was an astonishing thing to say under the circumstances. I don't know if I'd be able to say that to someone who wrote to me with such a statement. But and the other thing was that publishing the first book, people's responses made me realise how ununique I am and how ununique my experiences are. People many times said, oh, this so reminded me of this part of my life, or yes, I know exactly how that felt because... And it's a really thrilling thing to find out that you're actually fully a member of the human race. Because I think writers, being weird, lonely sorts of people, we get the idea that we're sort of a bit like aliens. And I get that feeling anyway, and I know other writers who said similar things to me, just that feeling that there's something awful about you and that you've got this terrible eye that looks at people and won't not see. But the number of people who made a point of telling me that one guy wrote to me and said, I remember how it rained that year in Sydney. You know, that even that kind of detail recognition was extremely thrilling to me, just to think that we were on the same planet, you know, in both in the book and in real life.
I am very glad that you can't stop that eye seeing, but I do think one of the products when you read it is intense, kind of the discomfort of intense recognition. I think that experience you describe of feeling like you're part of the human race when you go back over it is an intense feeling in reading it. You said just at the start, you talked about the kind of anxiety of looking backwards. And there's a passage very early on in the new collection where you're asked by V, is The Fatal Shore the kind of book you'd rush out and buy? And you respond, of course not. I've got no feeling for the past at all. He replies, you've got a pretty strong sense of the present though, haven't you? A character with no sense of the past, but with such a sense of the present that she can be used as a gauge in any situation. I'm interested in the experience of going back over your own diaries and how much that feels like kind of reliving a perpetual present, if you like, rather than delving into the past.
Hmm. I'm glad that some of it did seem like the past to me, especially in this second volume. There's this kind of ghostly feeling, you know, brooding over a detailed record of your own life, and you can't. I mean, I think this must be what it's like to be a ghost, if they do exist. If you come back and you go to the places where you were once alive, and there's nothing you can do about it. It can't be changed. You can't change it now. It's too late. And just kind of hovering over your own past is you're just confronted with the fact. And you can't, that's another part of deciding. I mean, I think if to write a memoir is a completely different proposition, because you can you can excuse yourself retrospectively. You can say, well, of course, you know, I did that then when I was 30, but now I wouldn't dream of doing it because now I'm so mature and psychologically sophisticated. But you can't do that with a diary, and that's the kind of tonic effect that it has had on me anyway. I was like, Jesus, what an idiot I was back then. And couldn't I see the exit doors? Every now and then an exit door to a situation I was in would rear up in front of me, and I would totally fail to see it and would just stroll straight past and off the cliff. That was really quite shocking to me. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
No, it does. I think the thing of the many things I admire about these two books, one of the things that really shocks me is how personally bracing it must be to live in your own past like that, to be back. You know, shame in particular is an emotion that I think lives in you physically afterwards. And if you can conjure up the memory of the thing that caused you shame, it's as real as it was back on the day it was. And I wonder, in excavating these diaries, how much you're torturing yourself over these old kind of emotions, these old conflicts, these old beliefs.
A lot. A great deal. Guilt and shame and remorse. And much more a sense of remorse than a sense of grievance, I have to gladly say. I imagined when I went back that I would sound a lot more aggrieved in the diaries than I turned out to. I mean, this second volume is, there are various strands that run through it. It sort of functions on many different levels, but there's one of those strands is the story of a relationship between a man and a woman. And that takes up a lot of psychic space, or it does to me when I'm thinking and working about it. But I did feel a certain concern about writing, about publishing a lot of that material. But I would wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and I would think, how can I possibly say that? How can I put that in? And I would lie there sweating and groaning and thinking, okay, as soon as I get up in the morning, I'm going to take that out because it's outrageous to say that. Then I'd get up in the morning, go and sit at the desk, and I'd look at the passage in question, and I'd realise that, as usual with everything that one tortures oneself about at 2 o'clock in the morning, it seems in daylight quite different. It's as if there's a part of you that doesn't function at 2 o'clock in the morning. And so you can go down a gurgler of horror and shame and remorse. And then when you, in daylight comes and you get up and whatever that thing is that doesn't work at 2 o'clock in the morning is working again, it's on. So I'd go and sit at the desk and I'd turn to the part that I had got the horrors about at 2 a.m. and I'd think, but it's perfectly all right because it's just one tile in this huge mosaic. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, I would have been holding it up in tweezers and in a lab, you know, with a fierce white light beaming on it, completely stripped of context. And I mean, I'm just getting the shivers thinking about this. But then in the morning in daylight and put it back into its context and it's altered by its context and it's softened and it's given meaning and it absorbs meaning from the things around it. So that's one thing I experienced that over and over and over. And like many things that I'm just going to quote the epigraph to illustrate this point. And the epigraph of the book is a quote from a book called An Experiment in Leisure, which is by the late Marion Milner, who was a psychoanalyst in London. Everything that one thinks one understands has to be understood over and over again in its different aspects, each time with the same new shock of discovery. I think that's one of the most useful points anybody's ever made. And it's in itself, it has to be churned over and over again. It's as if there are some things that one cannot learn. They just have to be learnt through experience, and somehow you strip yourself of that learning and you go back into the surf and the next wave hits you and you think, God, and then you think, oh, but wait, it's the same wave. I know how to surf this wave. But you can never really believe that about yourself at 2 a.m.
No. That makes perfect sense. One of the, I think the mosaic parallel is a really useful one, because one of the things that characterizes both these books, I think, is that that mosaic is, beside the kind of what I've heard you refer to in the past as the muscle that runs up the kind of middle of the book, I think you're right, one of the key ones in this second volume is that relationship. But actually the mosaic is about your various friendships, your relationships with your daughter, with your sister, with your peers. And that kind of richness, that richness is where the kind of deep pleasures in this book lie, is the ways in which those kind of characters come to the fore. I'm interested in your decision to make your nun, to refer to your nun as your nun rather than by a letter of the alphabet, which for those who haven't got to either of these volumes yet, most people's identity is obscured by a single letter, but there are a couple, like the born again or the law student or your nun, who get a special epithet of their very own. What made that decision clear to you?
Well, at the beginning of the first volume, I thought I was going to be able to use an epithet for everybody and I wouldn't have to name anybody. So I mean, I was quite concerned with the whole matter of identifying people, and I thought, oh, man, I had a few epithets that I'd worked out, like the law student and the born again, as you mentioned, that were kind of memorable epithets. But I'd been reading Homer in a reading group, and once you see a Homeric epithet, you know, the grey-eyed goddess, you know, that kind of thing, it's so attractive. But my very sensitive and quietly tough editor, Jane Pearson, pointed out that this was not going to work. She said, over the length of, you know, however many pages it is, no reader will be able to hang on to those characters. So then she suggested I should give them people initials. But, of course, you know, there's only, what, how many letters are there in the alphabet? Not enough for the number of people in the book. But that's not why I kept the epithets. Some of the epithets seem to me to be so, they were mostly people who were dear to me or that I had a very particular respect for or love for or fear of. There's the great reader, for example, which is the old woman who was, you know, a wonderful old person who knew everything. And there's the adventurous beauty, which I so enjoyed thinking that one. I sweated over that one for a while. But my nun. See, I had a friend who was a nun, and I met her through one of my sisters. And when we first met, she was still a nun. She was American in a French order, which had its little branch in Melbourne. And so she was one of those nuns who they call the Little Sisters of Charles de Foucault, and Little Sisters of Jesus of Charles de Foucault. And that's an order that I think started in the Sahara or somewhere. They're people who go and live, you know, at the bottom level of society and do their work there. And I don't know, I got to know her, and she was just a very funny, lively person and really quite hilarious. But over the period that I knew her, she got leukemia, and she discovered that every time she left the house, I mean left where she was living, that her blood picture improved. I mean, she'd go home to America, for example, on a brief family visit, and her blood picture would enormously and immediately improve. And every time she came back to be with the sisters, it would get worse. And so after this happened a couple of times, she kind of got the message and she thought, well, I'm going to leave. So she left the order. And I was interested in... Sorry, I'm going off on a tangent about the nun, I think. I greatly admired her. She was a hilarious and admirable person within a very interesting, weird past, which she revealed to me as the case went on. But I really loved her. One reason why I loved her was because she had the whole godly business sorted out in a very practical way. And there's a scene in it where I'd go to stay with her and her girlfriend, because she then had got a girlfriend, and they were living in a remote country town, and I took her to get a blood transfusion one day, and on the way back she said, drop in at the presbytery, because I want to pick up a consecrated host, a communion wafer. So I go, okay. So I'm sitting in the car outside, and she comes out with this wafer, and it had been specially blessed for the nuns, and she just says to me, you want to go Harvey's? I go, okay. So she just snapped it in half and said, this is Jesus, this is all things good, and she just handed me half of the wafer, and I started eating it. And I just sort of drove away still eating it. And I thought, that is an image to me of how religion can fit into ordinary life. You don't have to have a golden palace. You know, you can just say, here, let's share it and hand it over, and you just take the wheel and drive away. And so I just adored this nun. You know, anyway, she died.
I love that story, and your love of her comes through really beautifully in the book. I think the reason I wanted to ask about her is it seems to me things like belief and faith are positions that change for us drastically across our life. And I'm curious about how, for those, whether it's political beliefs, and we'll get to the publication of the first stone and the stuff around that, I suspect, in a minute, but things like your own personal faith and religion and understanding of your place in the world, do you read younger Helen and feel very differently to the way she did about those things, or do you feel that you're of a piece with her?
Oh, of a piece, I suppose, but as you say, those things fluctuate. I wasn't raised with any Christian belief, or my parents weren't, I was never baptised as a child. They just weren't interested. I just happened to have been sent to a church school, a private school. So at an Anglican school, you get to learn about the prayer book and the Bible, and you're familiar with them and familiar with the stories that are in the Bible and why they're interesting and important. And then as I sort of moved away from it and fashionably scorned it, as everyone did back in the 60s. All people that I hung out with did in the 70s. And I just, as things, as my life, the difficulties in my life fluctuated and became severe, or painful things happened, people died, it just seemed to me a series of images and thoughts and stories that were sustaining to me at certain moments when not much else was sustaining. And that's all I can say about it, really. Yeah.
Thank you. We have a question from Megan. Megan, are you ready?
Hi, Helen.
Hello.
I was just thinking, did you have a sense of certain phases of your life as being like happy or harder phases? And did going back to the diaries and editing and shaping them, did that change how you thought about certain times of your life? And now do you have like this sense of distinct different times after like turning them to books?
Yeah, I do, particularly now, because now I've been on my own for 20 years now. And I would say that this has been the happiest time of my life, partly being a grandmother and finding out that, learning that there was a sort of love that was also a kind of service, and putting myself at the disposal of people that I love instead of fighting for a place to stand. Those times that I talk about in the diary that are, which are sort of fights for self, really, I find them hard to talk about outside the actual text. But yeah, there are some times where I feel that I behaved. I don't like the way I've behaved at certain times, and it was painful to me to see them again. But you have to accept that you did those things and somehow make yourself large enough to think, okay, I've done that. I did that, and that's what I was like back then. And it shows you the parts of your personality that tend to make themselves felt in a crisis, for example, or the parts where you see that you wimped out and that you didn't have the guts to get a grip on the situation you'd allowed yourself to be in. I've got a friend who's terrified of death. He's not sick or anything, but he just is. And he told me that he said to his psychoanalyst, is there any advantage at all in getting old? And the psychoanalyst said, perspective. That was his one-word answer. And I can, tomorrow is my birthday and I'll be 78. And so I can tell you that you get perspective as you get older, and it's a fantastic thing.
Thank you. Looking forward to it.
It's funny the ways in which you talk about courage and looking back at when you were courageous in the past. And one of the things that comes through again and again in these diaries is that often you write like you feel like the diaries are the place where you are being brave when you're cross at yourself for not being brave in person, if that makes sense. There's a reference early on where you're on Bondi Beach and you're thinking about all the things you want to write, and you refer to all the things I slid away from writing last year because I was scared. Mm. And of course, they're all things that we have at this point now read in your diaries from the year before, that you have the courage to confront them in the page for yourself, but not have them go through into your work. How much do you see these as a kind of document of private bravery and regretted kind of public fear?
Mm. Well, one thing about a diary is I have to stress this now, that I never imagined that they would be published when I was writing them. I always thought that I could, there would be stuff in there that I could use in my books, but I never thought of them as being published. So in a sense, a diary can be, it's a very bracing resource that you've got if you're using it brutally, you know, toughly with yourself and not using it just as a place to kind of whinge and declare your own perfection and everybody else's failure to perceive that perfection. I suppose in a way a diary is just a set of notes, even no matter how carefully you compose it. It's a set of notes, contemporaneous notes, that you on experiences that you, in a sense, not ready to process yet. So that 20, 30 years later you go back and look at it and you think, oh, yes, my memory of that wasn't quite right. I had a self-favouring memory of that, and I see that in that situation I actually did behave appallingly. Or else you go back and say, oh, yes, I remember that I'd been a total wimp back then and that I had no guts at all and that I just lay down and let the truck go over me. And then you go back and you say, oh, no, I didn't. This happened and that happened. It's just there are these little details that you write down that, as it were, enable you many years later in retrospect to understand what was really going on. Not sure if that answers your question either.
Yeah, absolutely does. We have a question from Sandy. Hi, Sandy.
Looking for Sandy.
Yeah, at the moment, drag out just beyond when I could pretend I was ready.
No, that's fine. I have to wait for the host to unmute me. Thank you very much, Michael, for this wonderful opportunity. Helen, happy birthday for tomorrow, I understand.
Oh, thanks.
I'm a journal writer and have been for many years. I started writing a journal in 1969 when I was, way big. And I look back on my journals and my diaries, and I am horrified by some of the things that I thought and wrote about. And so my question to you is, were there any parts of your past that you reviewed when you were going through this process that also sort of surprised you about yourself, or horrified you, or made you stop and really question who you are today because of the emotions and the feelings that you had when you were writing the diary and the juxtaposition of what you are and who you feel you are now. Do you understand what I'm asking?
I think I do. There are times I look back on. I'm thinking about George Saunders, who's a writer I greatly admire, an American writer, and he was once asked what he regretted when he looked back on his life, and he said, "I regret more than anything else my failures of kindness." And I do feel I felt that quite strongly. I felt my I get appalled at examples of my selfishness, or what I see from here as selfishness back then, narrowness. I think though that I know that some people write diaries differently from me. I'm very interested in the small events of life, the little things that happen, the sort of chair that you have in the kitchen, or what someone said to you down at the supermarket, or things like that that are extremely immediate and practical in a sense. There's a lot of material objects that I notice in my diaries when I go back and look at them. Things that I see, or so I don't really find, I don't find that I have written this is what I think about something in a great flowing text, you know, or these are my, this is what I think the world is like now, or I'm a feminist because, and like page after page. I know that some people use their diary in that way, and I've never done that. I'm always much more inclined to write a sort of chunky little daily report. And I'm suddenly thinking of something I read once about how somebody looked at a whole lot of diaries that women had kept in France during the French Revolution. And I think this person was a man, and he went back and, you know, looked at all these diaries, and he was really surprised to find that they hardly ever mentioned the French Revolution. I mean, it was this enormous crashing disaster and thrilling event that was going on all around them, but they were writing about what happened that day, what happened when they went to the market, how much things cost, or what clothes, you know, if the shoes they got were going to suit them, or what their children said to them. And so that's why I don't usually go back and find a coherent account kept at a previous moment of what I thought about anything. I usually might say things like, as the publisher put on the poster, they sent me the poster and I opened it up. And the first thing, they've got all these excerpts from the things on little little garlands, and one of them said, privately, I consider this to be bullshit. And I just burst out laughing. I remembered immediately what it was that I was talking about. But I thought, isn't it interesting, these young women who are, you know, these young publicists and designers who are looking at my diary, that would be something that jumped out at them. And I think, yeah, you're not sort of supposed to say that kind of thing anymore. Everybody's so careful about what they say. And I wasn't, the thing about a diary is you don't have to be careful about what you say. So you can say quite brutally what you think about things, but you don't have to develop a whole rationale that goes on for pages. This probably isn't quite what you were getting at, but anyway, I hope it's relevant to some extent.
Privately considering something to be bullshit is the great luxury, isn't it? you don't have to have the fight in the moment. There are moments in this that read like kind of teasers for a narrative to come. I'm thinking in particular of your description of attending your first autopsy, for example, which is a beautiful scene, and your kind of wonder at the competence and professionalism of the people there, and your happiness radiates off the page. It's a description of someone who feels like she's arrived somewhere where she belongs. That must have extra resonance when you're going back over the edit and you come across a passage like that. That must just must carry a lot of weight and significance to this day.
Yeah, well, that particular experience was, you know, I was thunderstruck by that experience. I spent, well, I don't know, 3 or 4 days down at the morgue, and I don't know what I learnt. I learnt something that was beyond putting down in a sentence or two. But, yeah, I guess when I get to volume 3, which I'm going to start working on as soon as after Christmas maybe, I think I'm going to discover in there stuff about courts, discovering courts. And I think it may be that discovering the law and courts and that I could write about them was the most wonderful gift to me. Just, I mean, as a person of mature years, suddenly I walked into a court and blam, you know, this bomb of meaning went off. And I connect that back, in a sense, with the visit to the morgue, in the sense that a court and a hospital and a morgue, they're places of extreme seriousness where a human existence is being dealt with within a very firm structure, an agreed upon structure. And people there are, well, they're either dead or they're in extremis. And it seemed to me it's an enormous privilege to be able to go to those places and be free to observe and use what's happening there. I feel that very strongly, and I think that's part of what you mentioned about the sort of happiness that came out of that. I know there are some people, I mean, the whole point time that I was, you know, just editing back that section, I think some people are going to think I'm really weird. This is really gross and grotesque, but instead of which, I mean, I don't care if they do, because it was such, I was thunderstruck by that experience and deeply moved and empowered by that experience that I had, and I'll never forget it.
I don't think it comes across as weird at all, because as in your journalism, it's so through the lens of a real tenderness towards the human beings who are kind of enacting drama of that place, and that seems to me to be your kind of, your real gift is bringing that human element of that space to life. The other part of it, though, is that whether it's a morgue or a courtroom, they're places that have their own peculiar language and a language that can exclude. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting reading the way you write about them in your diary, that is well and truly borne out in your journalism, is finding a language to talk about these somewhat cloistered spaces in a way that lets people in. Reading back over this, did you have a sense of that as something you had to learn, or was that intuitive?
Oh, I could see I would have to learn it, and that's part of the thrill of it, of course. I mean, see, I feel that I like my writing to be as close to speech as it can get without losing a necessary formality of structure. And that's the kind of writing I like to read as well. I really love it when you feel that the person's, you can hear the voice clearly, and there's a sort of warmth of the human presence there. But I'm not thinking to myself, oh, I've got to make this warm and human. I'm just thinking, I've got to make it sound like I'm just talking. And I figure that I had another wonderful experience was a few years ago, which was to be invited to be one of the, as it were, writing teachers at workshops for judgment writing, judges and magistrates, because they're, you know, the idea being that what they write in their decisions should be accessible to the ordinary human being in the street, and they shouldn't be clogged with jargon, and they had to be chiseled and jackhammered out of the language that they've been trained to use. And I found that was very interesting, working with the judges and magistrates, because they were, I realised how much of the excluding way they wrote was caused by fear. It took me a while to twig that, because I was terrified of them. You know, I thought they'll think I'm stupid because I don't know their legal jargon. I don't know it, and I've got no way of finding it out before next Thursday morning. And so I'd turn up, I'd be on the tram in a sweat of fear because they would have sent us out these judgments, these decisions that we had to, that I and the other writers had to sort of read, and we were going to sit down with the people who'd written these judgments and say, and pull them apart and say, you know, you've got to reduce this by 2/3. And seeing I didn't know what the judgment meant, what it was about, I thought I'm about to be exposed as the most biggest idiot and they'll despise me. Anyway, so I'm sitting opposite this magistrate from Kalgoorlie and he'd written a judgment about a case and it was about 10 pages and I had no idea what it was about. I just could not make head or tail of it. And I said to him, he was a really nice bloke. You know, I said, look, I've got a problem with this. I have no idea what this is about. I said, can you tell it to me in a sentence? And he said, oh, okay. He said, well there's this bit of land, right, and it's got some gold in it. And I said, well, but you haven't mentioned that. It's not there. It's not in the judgment. There's nothing about land. There's nothing about gold. And he goes, why would I put that in? And I just thought, oh. But as it turned out, you know, I explained to him that if he could tell me the story in speech, then we could figure out a way to write that without and lose the jargon. And this was a great revelation to people in the group. But and the transformation in what they were writing was so extreme. It was really quite wonderful. But I say, what are you afraid of? Why are you so clogged with this? What are you afraid of? And they'd say, the court above. Because their greatest terror is that the court above, that will be appealed, and that the court above will find there's something inadequate in their judgment. And so they put everything in, they just truckload it in and pour it in, and they back up a truck full of concrete and pour it in. And the judges in the court above don't want to see that. They want to see the muscle of the thing. They're saying, what happened? And the question is, who did what and to whom? That's the question they had to ask themselves instead of going where to for and with regard to and all that sort of clogged crap they would go on with. And so I took away that lesson to myself. I thought that's the way I want to think about this as well. I want people to know immediately what I'm talking about and for no reader should ever have to fight their way through a load of fear-induced crap on the outside of anything.
Does that ultimately mean that there's a discernible difference between reading your diaries and reading your journalism or your books? Because the diaries, presumably at the time, were written without an idea that there would be a court above?
Hmm. Yeah, well, there's no feeling of a court above. But there is a feeling of a court above in most things you publish. But I don't know, the older I get, the less I fear that and the less I... Partly because I think I am the bloody court above. You know, I'm the court above for other people's writing now. But I had to fight my way to get there and I never thought it was never my aim. But, you know, the older you get, the less you fear, I think.
I want to touch upon a bit of that fight in a tick, but we have a question from Alex that we should throw to first. So, Alex. Seamless technology, I love it.
It'll happen.
Oh, I believe. Like the US election, we'll get a result soon.
Ooh, yeah, that's a sore point. Where's Alex?
We may have lost Alex. Then I will jump straight to my next question, which was, oh, Alex is ready, apparently. Sorry, I've just checked my message. We're going to let Alex go for a moment. You talk about having to fight to have that courage to be your own court above. One of the things this new volume culminates in is the publication of The First Stone, and there is a kind of, for longtime fans of your work and people who have followed your career, there's a palpable sense of dread when on the page your entry reads, the Master of Ormond has just been these things. And it sits there just as a curious and interesting news story at first. And then bit by bit, it takes hold as a story that you decide you want and need to tell.
Yeah.
What was it like going back over that process for the purposes of this book?
Well, interestingly, I expected there would be more about it in the diary. But then I thought, hey, come, where's all that other stuff? And then I realised that other stuff was actually in, because I have this sort of series of diaries and journals. And I, when I first decided that I was going to write a book about that, that's when I started a separate sort of daily journal about that case and the inquiries that I was making into it and the obstacles that I ran into and the people that I interviewed and the people who wouldn't talk to me. I'd sort of, there's a kind of billabong effect there, you know, that there's a whole other set of journals. And this is the case about every nonfiction book that I write. There's a sort of process journal that goes with it. And that's separate from and different from my daily diary. And those are all gone away. So it wasn't, there's hardly anything in it about the research that I did for the book or the interviews, but there's a fair bit in it about the shit canning I got when the book came out, which was rather painful and awful.
I think one of the things about reading about that kind of response was in a kind of what must have been incredibly upsetting microcosm, the experience of publishing something and having readers respond to it in a way that didn't fit with your expectation or your intention. One of the things coming out of the diary is the times when the kind of brickbats seemed to be coming in bad faith, that people were interested in the fight rather than in kind of having the conversation. There's an interview where you go in carefully prepared, having read the interviewer's book on the subject, actually welcoming and ready for a kind of conversation between people who didn't agree, and instead you got hung out to dry. Would you approach that? How much did that change the way you write a book and you think about an audience when you write a book?
Oh, well, the whole experience of the first stone and what happened afterwards was really awful and painful but enraging. But when it was over and I kind of got up and dusted myself off, I thought, okay, I've got the other end of that. Now I can say anything I want and I'm going to. And I felt that what it did was blasted me out of a kind of reflexive type of feminism that I'd had, that I'd been writing from within ever since I started out. And I think that was, you know, I mean, feminism came like a bombshell to my life in the early 70s. And enabled all sorts of things for me. I mean, it's been the most liberating force for me in my life, and I'll always be grateful for that. But like all mighty social movements, you know, had a tendency to sort of calcify, and if you said the wrong thing, you were heretical, and there was, you know, factions formed and gangs formed, and I found that awful. And I knew I was going to hit a lot of, you know, heavy surf after that book came out, but I didn't quite expect this sort of mean-spirited spitefulness of a lot of it, and I was shocked by that. And but I did think, all right, now I don't. Oh, you know, one more thing. When I started out as a writer, people like me were called women writers. We weren't just called writers. You know, it was so surprising to find us there. And but then I thought, what happened after the first stone made me think, all right, well, I'm not beholden to anybody now. I'm not writing as part of a movement or as part of a gang. I don't owe my loyalty on every level to this movement. And I can say whatever I want to. And that was quite exciting and wonderful, actually.
I'm going to read you Alex's question because she came to be asked, and I'm not sure why we lost her, but she wanted to ask whether the fact that now you're publishing your diaries and you're on this track and volume 3 will come next, has it changed the way you write in your diaries every day now? Do you
Oh, that's an interesting question. No, not really, because I'm not imagining that these ones are going to be published. I'm imagining that maybe I've got another book or two of the older ones, and then I'll stop. That's my fantasy. I mean, I can't go on and on. Everyone will go crazy, including me. But really, I think that what I'm doing now and what I'm living now, I'm just writing as I would. I noticed that I actually, especially this is a lockdown thing, I was emailing with various people on you know, in rather full ways, and often I just print them out and stick them in into the diary, and that's what I do instead of writing by hand. Whereas all the diaries that are represented in the first two volumes of the published ones, they're all written by hand. But there's some email-y type of stuff. But no, I think... I'm still interested in writing about the sort of nitty-gritty of ordinary daily life as I was early on. Yeah, so I don't know if it's really changed. It hasn't made me more self-conscious, if that's what you mean, Alex.
You released in the monthly just a couple of months ago your lockdown diaries from this period in Melbourne, and it was lovely to read. There was a clear kind of through line from reading these diaries from 30 odd years ago to your diaries now. One of the things I really wanted to ask you about, one of the things that I found very moving in this second volume was your account of your parents and your relationship with them. And that seemed to me, I felt very grateful and privileged to have access to read it, and it struck me that it felt like almost a different register of personal, that it must have been very very painful to kind of share those kind of reflections publicly. Were there, in the second volume, there was nothing that you attempted to excise because it was just too much?
You mean about my parents?
Yeah. Were there any points where, I don't know, if I were in your shoes, Helen, trying to edit and write my diaries like this, I think I would need so much therapy during the process to even survive it. I'm just curious about the
thing. Why? Because it would make you mean because it would make you feel badly about yourself in the past, or that it was too revealing of the people you were writing about, or?
I think because there's a palpable sense of loss, it seems to me, in this second collection. The first one's one of its through lines was about loneliness and distance and isolation. And for this second one, it was about a particular kind of, it struck me as being about a particular kind of love and trying to find a language for that love. And so it meant the sense of grief and loss was palpable. But maybe I'm just projecting.
No, the stuff about my parents, both my parents are dead now, God bless them, and there was stuff about my mother. It pains me to think about my mother, and I fought my father ever since I was a teenager. We just fought, and then I always used to think that I'd be glad when he died and that I'd be able to, that I would be able to get to my mother and know her in a way that I never did properly, I felt, because my father was this big figure engaging me fully. But of course, what actually happened was that she died first, and so then I found that I had to deal with my father one-on-one, and that made me realise how there's a theme that runs through this second diary, which is, everybody thinks that the world is made up of couples, but it's actually made up of triangles. And that, of course, applies with bells on to one's relationship with parents. So that when one of the parents dies, suddenly you think, oh, well, now this is different. You know, everything swings and sways. And so I found I ended up with my father living next door to me, and we got on like a house on fire, you know, we had a few quarrels, but I discovered that I liked him, and I discovered that he was really funny, And we'd drive along in the car laughing our heads off and go and have a coffee and things like that. And I was thunderstruck by that, because that's going to happen in book three. So now I've blown it. But, yeah, so it pains me about my mother. I used to think it will be great when Dad dies, because then I won't have to think about him anymore, and I can deal with Mum and make it right with Mum, and all the difficulties that I had with being, you know, cleverer than my mother, which, and more highly educated than my mother, which caused me a great deal of angst and impatience and things I'm ashamed of. That's where I feel that lack of kindness and regret for lack of kindness. I'd give anything if she'd walk in here now and I could be sweet to her and you know, but they go and they're gone.
Yeah. God. We had a question come from Caroline Baum, who is here in the audience. We're too short for time to try the live cross again, but she was interested when you talked about shame and you talked about kind of guilt, and it was regret in particular she wanted you to elaborate on, and you shared the George Saunders quote with us. Does regret feel useful at this point? Does it feel like an...
Yeah, it's not too late. I mean, like, if you discover regret in a useful way before you're actually on your deathbed, you learn what it is. That's the thing about looking back at a diary. You see the sort of strands of your character, and you see what parts of you are ugly and defensive and what parts are angry when some other feeling would be more better. And you get to know yourself. You say, look out here, this comes again. This, it's heading for me, and if I just stay calm, I won't have to react to it the way I did back in, you know. So, I mean, I actually do find that I've learned things about myself that have been very useful, and a lot of those have come through the regret and sorrow that I feel for the years when I didn't know myself well enough to limit myself and to love someone cleanly.
I hear what you're saying, and I think you have deep reserves of self-knowledge that radiate out of these diaries. But I also think, as I thought in the previous volume, you're way too self-critical. What comes across again and again is the sheer generosity and kindness that you, with which you share your life with the people who appear in the books, and which you share these diaries with us, your readers. And so on this birthday eve, which seems a very auspicious time to get to talk to you, I would like to thank you very much for joining us for this chat. And I'm sure everyone else in this chat would join me in thanking you very much. You are unique.
I'm not, but thank you so much. Thanks. This has been really fun. Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Helen.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe to and rate our channel.